Hey there, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight, Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. On the show tonight...
Stateville is just an example of a place that needs a lot of work.
The death of a man incarcerated at Stateville Prison has advocates questioning if it should be closed even sooner. Mayor Brandon Johnson.
Addressing our residents' mental health needs and improving our response to mental health crisis is critical for the future of our city.
Mayor Brandon Johnson promises big advancements for mental health care access. And as Chicagoans start training for fall marathons, meet the founder of a run club whose message is to run your way, even if it's slow AF. And now to some of today's top stories. We've been following the men who graduated from Northwestern University while incarcerated for the last couple of years. In that time, we've detailed some of their successes as well, like being exonerated or getting into a top law school. But today, a tragic story for one of those graduates. Michael Broadway died while incarcerated at Stateville Correctional Center last week. And now family members and attorneys have questions about how he died. During the graduation ceremony for Northwestern Prison Education Programs, or NPEP's first cohort of graduates.
Late last year, I didn't think I'd be standing here.
Michael Broadway received a special shout out from commencement speaker and renowned author Ta-Nehisi Coates.
I was just reading through some of the bios and I read someone here was, you know, coping with stage 4 prostate cancer as they went through the program, you know. And brother, you the same one that, this is your book too, right?
Having survived that cancer while in prison, his classmates believe complications from asthma and heat are to blame for his death on June 19th at 51 years old. Temperatures that day reached 91 degrees in Joliet, where Stateville Correctional Facility is located. But in emails provided to WTTW News, Broadway's classmate Anthony Ehlers writes, quote, "They have a huge exhaust fan in front of my cell and Mike's cell that have been padlocked. Not a single window is open. Everything we have for ventilation purposes in the 9 gallery is either closed or locked. Mike and I tried numerous times for a month to get them to take the lock off the fan or to open some windows." Another classmate, Abdul Malik Muhammad, writes, quote, "We have all been complaining about the heat. It's very hot without any form of ventilation. It's not even any working fans. All the fans is broke. One of my classmates was complaining about the heat and explaining that he couldn't breathe." He also says he, quote, "asked for someone to come open up the windows because they've been nailed shut with plywood due to structural damage. All the top windows is nailed closed. None of the industrial fans do not work." Broadway, who suffers from asthma, began calling for help along with other men because he was struggling to breathe. But the men report that a nurse refused to come up to 9 Gallery because it was, quote, too hot. When she finally did make it several minutes later, at the request of a correctional officer, Broadway was unconscious. Ehlers reports, quote, "She immediately injected him with Narcan, even though I told, and another inmate and I told her, that he had really bad asthma." He writes that eventually a stretcher arrived, but because it didn't have straps to secure the patient, his classmates carried him downstairs in a bedsheet. Ehlers says, quote, "He didn't have to die. What that tells me is we are not safe here. As a result of these conditions, our brother died." A spokesperson for IDOC would only confirm Broadway's death and that the investigation is ongoing. When Governor Pritzker was asked about the death at a separate event, he acknowledged conditions at Stateville poor enough to warrant its closure and rebuild, slated to begin in September.
It's very important that we carefully, but imminently, make changes in our correction system. In particular, we're going to need to close and replace Stateville. As you know, we commissioned a study last year that showed the terrible condition of some of our prisons and the need for significant investment. It had been disinvested from the entire prison system for many years, and we need to rectify that.
The state announced plans to demolish Stateville and rebuild it in the current location after a state commission report last year deemed it, quote,
not suitable for any 21st century correctional center. Advocates say Stateville's closure is long overdue, and for much more on that, please visit our website. Meanwhile, Broadway's attorneys say they were representing him for his post-conviction petition, where he claims to be actually innocent of the crime in which he's convicted, which is first-degree murder. He'd served 18 years of his 75-year sentence. A surprise in Lake County court today. The alleged Highland Park 4th of July shooter did not take a plea deal. Prosecutors had expected Robert Cremo III to plead guilty today and accept a life sentence without possibility for parole. A courtroom packed with victims and their families were there, only to see the defendant reject the plea, which would have ended the legal proceedings. The case is set for trial in February. Amazon drivers demonstrate outside a Skokie delivery facility. The drivers worked for Four Star Express Delivery, a company contracted by Amazon's logistics division to deliver packages. Those drivers filed a petition to unionize as members of the Teamsters last week. In a statement, an Amazon spokesperson said this protest was initiated and has been attended by mostly outside organizers and individuals who don't work for Amazon and has had no impact on our operations or ability to deliver for customers. Four Star Express Delivery is an independently owned company that voluntarily closed its business on May 30th and no longer delivers for Amazon. But drivers say it's Amazon. That's their true employer, since they wear Amazon uniforms and use trucks with the company's logo. Four Star Express Delivery did not respond to a request for comment. Up next, plans to expand access to mental health care right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Mental health advocates have long called for the city to reestablish 19 of the city-operated mental health clinics that were previously closed in Chicago. Candidates for mayor have campaigned on the promise to do so. Last month, Mayor Brandon Johnson started making good on that promise, announcing plans to reopen the Roseland Health Clinic and phase out police involvement in mental health crises. Joining us now with more on the mayor's plan and what effects it might have are Northwestern University Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences Professor Inger Burnett Ziegler, Kamisha Jones, Executive Director of Sista Afia, Community Strategy Specialist Candace Coleman from the organization Access Living, and Kathleen Guada with the Chicago Foundation for Mental Health. Thanks to all of you for joining us. I want to start first, if I could, with all of you and getting your reaction to Mayor Johnson's plans to reopen those previously closed health clinics. Inger, let's start with you, please.
You know, I think there's certainly enough unmet need in this city to go around. And so any efforts in order to provide more services to our residents, particularly in traditionally underserved communities, is an important one. But I think it's important that we recognize the magnitude of the problem. There are an estimated 300,000 people across our city that have unmet mental health needs. And, you know, I think it's important for us to consider how the reopenings of these three clinics is going to appropriately or perhaps not quite meet the needs of those individuals in our community.
Candace, same question to you. Is it necessary to have publicly operated you're Candace. Kamisha, same question to you. Is it necessary to have those publicly operated health clinics run by the city?
Yes, I believe that the more options that people have to open up access to mental health care services is needed. I know for many people in the community that were affected by the closing of the mental health clinics that there's still trust that needs to be built between the city in terms of like their investment and sustainability of these mental health clinics, but I believe it's a step in the right direction.
Kathleen.
Yeah, absolutely. Any investment in mental health is a step in the right direction, but I think the points made here were so important that, you know, we have to have a intentional approach to the problem and understand the magnitude of it, and really it can't just be certain fields involved in it. I really believe it's a big systemic problem, and we need to take a very intentional approach to it historically, one that we haven't taken historically. So that's what I would say.
Now, Candace, what's your reaction?
I'm super excited about this opportunity because this is literally what the people wanted. This is something that's been advocated for many years. And our mayor really listened and implemented what the community has asked for.
Do you think relying on private and nonprofit funders to fund this expansion will be enough?
I think that we need to look at it as an overarching investment in the continuum of care for mental health. I know funding is a big part of the conversation, but we really need to look at what people need, what their concerns are, and how do we address it. And so it's an investment in the community and what they need.
So you're saying it sounds like find the funds, right? It's think of all that would come from making this kind of investment.
Yes.
Inger, part of Mayor Johnson's promise is, of course, to phase out police response to mental health crises, and instead CARE, the alternate response teams, would double in size and be able to respond to those calls. Tell me a little bit about the significance of that, please.
You know, I think it's important that people recognize that when law enforcement is involved in mental health calls, that can lead to a potentially dangerous situation. When you have individuals that don't understand the symptoms that are presenting in that particular moment, that can exacerbate the crisis and lead to danger for both the individual as well as the other people that are being involved. As well as kind of increasing that pipeline of people with mental health needs ending up in the criminal justice system as opposed to getting the services that they need. So I think by involving social workers or other mental health staff that are appropriately trained to not only understand the symptoms that are presenting in the moment, but trained in de-escalation practices is critically important for the safety of the people involved, but also in the continuum of care that's been discussed.
Kanisha, you saw a need for mental health care access specifically for Black women. How does mental illness show up differently in that demographic, in our demographic?
Yeah, I think that Black women experience mental health conditions and concerns that all women experience, but they may have a greater intensity or a greater severity. Some of the things that impact Black women differently are poverty, discrimination, and economic challenges greatly impact women's ability to be able to access services and also to receive culturally responsive care. I also think that sometimes Black women are misdiagnosed for more severe mental health concerns, and that misdiagnosis can lead to gaps in treatment. So those are some of the things that I see that are different. And then I would also say depression, anxiety, and trauma are the most common mental health concerns that Black women experience. And Black women have higher rates of crime victimization and also sexual assault and domestic violence victims. So those are some of the things that I think that impact Black women differently, and also the combination of those stressors all happening at the same time.
Kathleen, tell us, if you would, a little bit about the work that you do at Chicago Foundation for Mental Health, because you have a pretty diverse team of providers at your organization.
Absolutely. Our purpose is to provide accessible and affordable solutions to mental health inside of the communities, and I can't stress enough what my peers here said about the importance of intentional and qualified professionals who are able to provide what the community needs, because we don't want people who live in communities of color receiving services that they get an adverse experience, then they're even further turned off. So we provide individual therapy services. Family therapy is a huge service we provide. We're in the schools on the southwest side of Chicago, and we also have an outpatient location at 79th and Racine, and we're available virtually. So we try to provide accessible, affordable care. We also do prevention work. We do different things. We're trying to uplift and support not only the communities, the people in the communities, but those leaders in the communities trying to make their communities better.
Candace, let's talk a little bit about the Treatment Not Trauma campaign from the Collaborative for Community Wellness, seeking to create a 24-hour mental health crisis hotline. How might a resource like this sort of mitigate the dangers of a mental health crisis?
Well, oftentimes, one, the timing of a mental health crisis is unknown. You never know when a person can go through a crisis. And so one of the ways that it can mitigate is having access to those services and supports at any point in time. The second thing is to make sure that at any point of entry, you could get access to care. And so having equal access to mental health care is important, because you could be on one side of the city or a different side of the city, and having to travel to and fro to get there usually exacerbates the situation. And so creating access points is extremely important for that.
We're almost out of time, but I mean, is there more that you think the city and the state could be doing to support the work that all of you are collectively doing? Kamisha, I'm gonna come to you for that one.
I think investment financially is always important so that these services can be sustained regardless of who's in office. But I also think there's a missing link between coordination of care. And there are many organizations that are doing great work. A lot of times people can look at like, we don't have enough. But what I've found is that we do have a lot of resources. It's the coordination and the knowledge sharing and the connection and the awareness that also deserves, you know, just as much attention as funding.
I see a lot of nodding heads around the coordination of care point. So I suspect that means you all agree, but we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Inger Burnett-Ziegler, Kamisha Jones, Candace Coleman, and Kathleen Guada. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Up next, a running club for people at any pace. Stay with us. Chances are you've already spotted several of these today. No, not cicadas, runners. The popular physical activity app Strava says running was its most uploaded sport of 2023. And organizers with the London Marathon say they received a world record amount of applications for its 2025 race. But with a growing number of recreational runners, questions about inclusivity have also risen. Our next guest says he didn't always feel welcomed in the sport. Now he's got a book to make sure everyone can get in on the run. It's called Slow AF Run Club, the ultimate guide for anyone who wants to run. And joining us now is author and 8-time marathoner Martinez Evans, who also started the online community, the Slow AF Run Club. And I'm sure that AF stands for Always Fun or Slow and Fun Run Club.
Slow and fabulous.
That's it. Martinez Evans, thanks for joining us. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
So you often tell the story of how you got started with running. A doctor told you that you needed to lose weight or you would die. Mm-hmm. You responded with, I'm going to run a marathon. He laughed. Why running? Had you considered running before that day?
Absolutely not. So I was being facetious when I told this doctor I was going to run a marathon. Because he was like, you know, you need to start walking on a track and things of that sort. I'm like, you don't even know who I am. So I'm going to show you who I am. So I was like, I'm going to run a marathon. And he laughed at me. And I was like, you know, I got to prove him wrong. So that's what I did.
Did you pull marathon out of the air, like, versus, you know, you could have started swimming or rowing or biking, but it was marathon?
Yeah, it just came out the air. You know, when somebody's calling you fat, you're trying to think about anything to not put hands on them. So I thought to myself, you know, the best thing I can say is, you know what, I'm going to run a marathon.
You've run 8 of them since you said those words. It was during one of those races, though, someone yelled something unkind. But you were inspired by it, by those words. What did they yell, and then what went through your mind?
So I was running New York City Marathon, and this guy told me, hey, buddy, you're slow AF. I ain't going to say the words, but he said, you're slow AF, and he told me to go home. So imagine being 15 miles into your marathon. You're already somewhat delusional. So I get into this argument with this guy, and once I finished the race, I was like, you know what? I'm going to do something to prove him wrong as well and create the Slow AF Run Club.
Was this a fellow runner who said this to you?
Brandis, I don't know.
It doesn't matter.
I don't know. This dude was on the side of the course with a beer in hand.
So not likely a runner with a beer.
Nah.
not running in the race with you, though.
Exactly. Not running the race with
you. Okay. Since starting the Slow AF Run Club, and, of course, you've written your book, which you brought to show us today, your story has, of course, been widely shared. You have you've been the cover story for Runner's World magazine, a nude photo shoot with Men's Health magazine. What does it mean to you to have your story and your image, you know, shared on these platforms and associated with this sport?
I think for me, it's definitely a big move, because when I started running 10 years ago, there was nothing out there that looked like me. So now that I'm out here and be able to show people that they can be active in the body that they are right now, they don't have to worry about changing their body. It's really is just so much for me to just be that beacon of hope for people out there.
What is it that you get out of running, besides, you know, giving to the members of your club and giving to others? What do you get out of it?
So running changed my life. Running gave me life. Running gave me something where I didn't necessarily think I was going to even be here on this earth. Running has given me the opportunity to travel around the world, running has given me the opportunity to chat with you. So running has given me everything.
We're doing okay.
Yeah.
It's also, running has also been sort of a mostly white dominated sport, right? Mm-hmm. Despite, you know, some very famous black people who we can all name who are runners, Richardson and Allyson Felix, Usain Bolt, they're all, you know, Olympians, but also they're faster runners, shorter distances, mm-hmm. right, in track and field. Why do you think more black people aren't into running, and especially long distance running?
I think that's a great notion, is that it really comes back to diversity. I know growing up as a little black boy in Detroit, nobody that I ever knew ran long distance. Everything was track, 100 meters, hurdles, things of that sort. I didn't even know what long distance running was until I even got into this thing. So I think it's one is awareness thing. But I also think that it goes deeper than that, right? It goes deeper to how in the neighborhoods we just don't have that that encouragement to do that. Yeah.
Okay. So a matter of encouragement. Do you think you've had an impact on that, on getting more black people into the sport?
I hope to seem so I'd have, yeah. Yeah.
Like in all of your travels, like what have you noticed in the people that you see and that you get to meet?
Oh, yeah. I think that when you're thinking about me traveling, I've been on a 50-day book tour. So I've seen various groups and various run clubs who have popped up, and they're majority people of color. So I think about here in Chicago, shout out to Peace Runners. I also think about the Tortugas, you know. And when you think about Detroit, you think about Rerun 313. So there are definitely various hubs of black men and women who are also starting to run. And I think these neighborhood clubs or crews, what you want to call them, is great for the community to get more black folk out there.
Some people get into running as a matter of weight loss or weight management, mm-hmm. And you've said it's never been about weight loss for you. You know, what else, when you're out running, you know, what does it do for you? What does it mean for you? Why a marathon? I always joke that, like, oh, a marathon, you run 26.2 miles to finish about three blocks from where you started. You didn't get very far. What do you get out of that long distance?
I get a lot of things. I think first things first is the satisfaction of proving people wrong. It's something about showing up to the finish line and somebody look at me and look at my size. It's like, oh, this is your first time? And it's like, nope. This is number 8, number 9, number 10. The other thing is that the process of training for a marathon, right? You can't BS a marathon. You know, the guy who even started, who even ran the first marathon died, right? So there is a lot of hard work and dedication to go with that. And I think that mindset that goes along with the repetition and training of marathon training makes me a better person.
Your book is part memoir, part guide for runners. Mm-hmm. What's something that you wish that you knew when you first started out?
So, funny story. One of the things that I wish I would have known when I first started out is this product called Body Glide. This thing,
you write
put
that
on,
down.
Yes,
people.
Put it down. Body Glide. You put it on all your moving parts, all your bits and your bites that move and rub together, and it will prevent what I call the chafe monster. So you go out there and you're running and you're thinking, oh, I'm good, and then you go take a hot shower and you feel like you've been cut by 1,000 razor blades. So I wish somebody would tell me about Body Glide a long time ago.
Do you find yourself dispelling any myths? For example, like, you know, the name of the club, Slow AF, right? Mm-hmm. It kind of like, I mean, even for me, an inspiration is it's okay to be slow.
Yeah,
it is okay to be at the back of the pack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
let me give you some game. Most races are permitted as a parade. Let that sink in. So there's no such thing as a race permit. There's only a parade permit. So once you get the elite athletes out the way, the people who are actually competing for money, all of us are participating in the parade. So there's, last time I checked, I ain't never seen a Santa Claus float try to beat out a Mickey Mouse float in the parade. Like, everybody's doing their thing and enjoying the journey along to the finish line. And that's how I see running races.
Sounds to me like an excuse to get dressed up.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
Put on something fun when you go for that run.
Right.
Last question, you know, before we let you go, what do you hope people take away from your book and from your experience?
One of the things I hope that people take away from this book is that they can do it. They can run. They can do whatever they want to be, right? Like, my story is about running, but this book and my story is really about proving the odds wrong and letting you know that you can do anything in your body. All you have to do is get up and start.
Okay. Martinez Evans, thanks so much for joining us. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
You bet.
Again, the book is called Slow AF Run Club, the ultimate guide for anyone who wants to run. And we're back to wrap things up right after this. And that's our show for tonight. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10 for Chicago Tonight Latino Voices. We'll have a preview of the hotly anticipated debate between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. And a new public art exhibit uncovers the history of an ancient civilization in Mexico. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm, and proud sponsor of programming that offers advice and strategies to enhance the physical and mental well-being of fellow legal practitioners in Illinois.